Hi there! You are listening to Diasporica, the podcast that bridges the Puerto Rican diaspora and Puerto Rico. In today's episode, we will present a conversation between Daniel Gastambide and I discussing the Puerto Rican psyche using as a reference Franz Fanon. We held this conversation at the Institute for Clinical Social Work for the psychotherapy and psychoanalytic community as a way to bring to the forefront in U.S. circles the invisible experience of how colonialism profoundly shapes the Puerto Rican experience of self and others. This conversation seems important even more given U.S. policies that drives mass migration of Puerto Ricans to the United States. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
And so without further delay, I'd like to introduce today's presenters. Morare Fernandez, LCSW, is a Puerto Rican psychotherapist practicing in Evanston, Illinois. She is a faculty member at ICSW and an adjunct professor at Smith College of Social Work. Her doctoral dissertation is on the subjective experience of immigrant psychotherapists of color. The findings will soon be published in the International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies. She is on the board of Boricuas Unidos and La Diaspora, as well as the creator, producer, and the voice behind the podcast, Diasporica, El Podcast. J. Daniel Gastambide, PsyD, is a Puerto Rican psychologist currently based in New York City. He is currently a professor in CUNY's college. He is also director of the Franz Fanon Lab for Decolonial Psychology. He recently published a book titled The People History of Psychoanalysis, From Freud to Liberation Psychology. And he's just come out with a book fresh off the presses, his second book entitled Decolonizing Psychoanalytic Technique. And Daniel will, during the Q&A, he'll put in the chat where you get a discount on that second book. So I'd like to welcome both Merari and Daniel. Thank you both.
I also want to welcome everyone to this presentation and those who will be listening through Diasporica podcast, because this conversation will be recorded for an episode of Diasporica, which is a podcast that aims to give a political voice to the diaspora, the Puerto Rican diaspora. And if you want to know more about the podcast, you can connect with us through our website page, diasporica.caperoni.fm. You can follow us on social media on Twitter at @PR_diasporica or find us on Facebook. Also, you can find a Spanish version of this podcast, and it's called ¿Qué es lo que pasa con la psiquis puertorriqueña? Lo que nos revela Franz Fanon. And so some people might wonder, you know, about the title of our presentation. I wonder what's up with the Puerto Rican psyche and why should we devote an entire presentation or conversation and episode to discuss it? Like, is there something wrong with Puerto Ricans? Is there something wrong in their heads that we need to discuss here? But we want to move away from pathologizing a group of people. That's not the intention of this conversation. But for Daniel and I, as Puerto Ricans, to talk about some issues we have encountered personally as a result of the colonial relationship, first through Spain and then with the United States, and how we have been impacted by it, or how our people have been impacted by it personally. And also how the context really impacts the psyche and how we can't divorce those two. Every time I start a podcast, I'm the one who presents the person who comes in. This time we were already presented, but I remember like thinking about how did I connect with Daniel. So I don't know if you remember this, Daniel. I knew about Daniel through a documentary, Psychoanalysis en el Barrio. And then I learned about him. Like, he was, then I saw his name on a presentation. I was like, oh, okay, so I'm gonna go. I know he's Puerto Rican. So I already knew he was Puerto Rican. I already knew, you know, he was in the documentary. But then I was in this presentation, he was presenting a case. And then there was the Q&A. And I remember, even though I already knew he was Puerto Rican, like, just being in the presentation is a whole experience of like, oh my God, a Puerto Rican is talking in a psychoanalytic circle. And I was like, it was like a very, you know, interesting experience to have, which I know other Puerto Ricans have every time another fellow Puerto Rican is succeeding, basically. And I remember when I posted this event, another Puerto Rican was like, I'm so proud to see two Puerto Ricans that they're succeeding. And so maybe for some other people, this might not be important. I remember like in that presentation, in the Q&A, I said, first of all, I just want to tell you, as a Puerto Rican, that I'm so proud to see a Puerto Rican here talking as a, you know, psychoanalysis and presenting. And I remember that Daniel was like, wepa! And that was, you know, it was such an important moment, you know, for me. And I keep, like, when I talk to other people about who I'm going to present with, I repeat this story. And I think it's a story of, like, that I've seen very often, like, since I was a child, like, seeing somebody succeed internationally as a Puerto Rican, like, it fills us up, like, our self-esteem, because for many years, we've been fed that we are not capable, that we are not good enough, that we are a small island, that we can't do it on our own. And so every time somebody succeeds, it's kind of like a proof that that's not true. It's kind of like pushing back on that colonial mentality. And I know we're going to talk about, you know, the context also of why, you know, like the context of Puerto Rico being a colony, but I just wanted to throw that out there, Daniel. I know I this wasn't planned, but I just wanted to share that with you.
Primeramente, buenas noches. Huepa, hoy y para siempre. No, I'm, you know, I'm so moved by your sharing that, right? Because that is, you know, we have this phrase, se te hincha el corazón, like your heart just bursts when you have that experience of seeing people in our community doing this work. And I know how important it's been for me to see that over and over again. So I feel incredibly honored and flattered to be able to provide that experience for you as well. What you were just talking about in terms of, like, you know, all these different things we hear growing up, and I know I certainly heard them growing up in Puerto Rico, the idea that we're not capable and we're just a small island, we don't have any meaningful resources. And there are so many ways that that was reinforced by different ideologies growing up on the island, but then, you know, so much more so migrating here to the US mainland. And getting essentially that same message that we are incapable. And I hope that our conversation can sort of balance out both how meaningful it is to see people in our community succeed, while also interrogating, you know, what does it mean to succeed? And how is it that those who succeed are then narrativized in a particular way? To give a concrete example, I've had friends who've said, oh, but Daniel Jose, you've made it, so the system works, right? And by the system, you know, as we'll get into, you know, we don't just mean, you know, we certainly mean racism, but we mean a particular kind of colonial structure that we would call racial capitalism or colonial racial capitalism, which is a structure that can be felt not only back home in Puerto Rico, but that textures so much of our experiences across communities here in the United States. So I guess having, you know, let the cat out of the bag in terms of some of the big themes we hope to tackle tonight, I think it's, you know, also very, you know, lovely for me to have this experience of having this conversation with you in the original podcast episode in Spanish, and to now sort of redo that conversation in English. And I'm sort of curious what may come out of us doing this in English, right? In this other second language that might be different from what it sounded like when we did it in Spanish. So researchers should compare what this conversation is like.
Yeah, definitely.
In English versus when we did it in Spanish.
And you know, maybe the big difference that I encounter is that we're going to start talking about the context and the history of, you know, of Puerto Rico and the U.S., and I don't remember doing that in a Spanish version. That maybe we feel like we need to educate the people around Puerto Rico. Although at the same time, it's like, why do I have to educate you on this? Like, you're supposed to know. This is a very, like, a response that a lot of Puerto Ricans feel. Not everybody, but, like, when we encounter ignorance around our reality because of our colonial status. You know, like, because we as Puerto Ricans, we had to learn so much about the US. It's cool. Back in Puerto Rico, actually, we take a US history class from first grade to 12th grade. But then when we come to the US, nobody, you know, I don't want to generalize, right? But a lot of people don't know basics about our political situation and what is even our relationship with the US. But we should say something, right? We should say something about our relationship.
I'll pull up the Wikipedia page on Puerto Rico and I'll share screen and we can all learn from the Wikipedia page together. So a little bit of like, you know, the history of Puerto Rico, like a crash course on the history of Puerto Rico. Well, story time, ladies and gentlemen, strap in. It's going to be a bumpy ride. You know, when people talk about the history of Puerto Rico today, a lot of people will start with the current U.S.-Puerto Rico relationship. And what I find interesting about that is we often forget that there was a prehistory to our time under the United States, which goes all the way back to the origins of colonialism. And I do think, in a way, kind of retreading that history is important because it provides a lot of context for the things we talked about in the original episode and hopefully we talk about tonight. So Puerto Rico, which was originally called Boriquen, what was one of the islands upon which the Spaniards landed during their second voyage to the so-called New World, to the Caribbean. And in landing in Puerto Rico, or essentially renaming Boriquen into Puerto Rico and conquering and subjugating the indigenous Taino people of the island, you had this process over the course of those first 100, 200 years of conquest, genocide, and enslavement. First enslavement of the indigenous people, but then the importation of African people captured, kidnapped, and enslaved and brought to the Caribbean to essentially continue extracting wealth for the Spanish crown. And our history is one that's, you know, drenched in a lot of violence, and violence that led to the creation of us Puerto Ricans in a way that's understood as tres raíces, un pueblo, three roots, one people. And the story goes that we are all sort of a third Spaniard, a third indigenous Taino, and a third African. And so there was a sort of mestizaje or mixture that occurred, firstly, because of the history of enslavement, because of the sexualized violence, and how this created this new people out of this history of violence. Part of what emerges because of that mixture is that under Spanish law, much like the laws of many colonial powers, if you were mixed or if you were not discernibly white, then you could not have access to, say, inheritance. You could not have access to certain wealth. So there are these funny anecdotes of many people in, you know, in New Orleans, you would call them the Creole class or de criollos, people who were mixed, going to the governor general and suing for inheriting certain properties from their parents and being told, well, wait a minute, but you're not white. How can, you know, I can't really give you these things. And they said, oh, the crown doesn't need to know. Just put us down as white on paper. So the first whiteness in Puerto Rico was a kind of whiteness on paper, white paper, as it were, where people who were very racially mixed and could be phenotypically brown or black could be encoded as white for the purposes of receiving certain wealth, etc. This nonetheless creates an anxiety among this Creole, Criollo elite that if they're not lighter and whiter, they're not going to have certain access both to economic markets or to the possibility of political autonomy. And so you had different political groups in Puerto Rico, some of which were very loyal to the Spanish crown, and some of which wanted their own autonomy and potentially independence. Now, for a lot of us growing up, when we take our, you know, history of Puerto Rico class, we look at this thing with sort of, how do you say, tint-colored glasses. Like, oh, these were the people who wanted independence for Puerto Rico. What makes the story complicated is a lot of the people who were pursuing autonomy for Puerto Rico were essentially pursuing that autonomy for the lighter skin, whiter, criollo class. and they engaged in different policies to try to whiten the population, such as encouraging more immigration from Spain to whiten the people of Puerto Rico through different laws that would criminalize the recently, in the 1800s, recently emancipated Afro-Puerto Ricans. So there were laws whose purpose was to criminalize a lot of darker-skinned people, and especially the women, in order to exert a pressure for people to pursue lighter and lighter skin partners. So there's this whole complexity of race and class in Puerto Rico in terms of what's going to make us good enough to deserve having autonomy and freedom. What's going to make us good enough to deserve economic mobility? And all of that was tied with whiteness, colorism, and anti-blackness. And we haven't gotten to the United States yet.
That's so similar in some ways to the, because it didn't get any better with the U.S. In terms of how the racist ideology also permeated all the actions and relationships of the U.S. with Puerto Ricans. So then after that, it was the Hispanic American War. Like Puerto Rico was given some kind of autonomy when the Hispanic American War happened. And then it was ceded or given to the U.S. as a property. And it makes things very complicated, especially for the locals, because, and this is something, you know, like the history books talk about, like there was some wealth being built up. Maybe like it was white Puerto Ricans, right? But it was an economy, you know, there were banks, there were some things that already established, and suddenly the U.S. takes over. And the economy somehow collapses for a lot of people, you know, like we had a coin or like our own way of exchanging merchandise, and that was devaluated, and suddenly a lot of people woke up to be poor. And then we are fed with all these ideas of like that we're incapable, that we don't have many resources for many years, and we become more dependent of the U.S. We didn't have a governor that we elected for a long time, even though we already had some those processes established in the island. So there were a lot of things that it kind of like we moved backwards somehow. And so then there were some racial relationships that were then complicated, right? Like that maybe you want to talk about, Danielle, in terms of like race in Puerto Rico when the U.S. took over.
I mean, you basically, you know, had it right, like not very much changed, by which I mean specifically the people who were the elites in Puerto Rico under Spain, they didn't go away when the U.S. took over. They just adjusted to a new colonial regime. So part of what happens when the U.S. takes over is that even though Puerto Rico was moving toward a form of autonomy under Spain, the U.S. came in and kind of did a remix of the same colonial message, which is, well, these are these sort of mongrel people. How could they possibly have the capacity to be free? Mm-hmm. How could they possibly have the ability to govern themselves? They're incapable of doing so because they're racially inferior. Exactly. And so you had this tension between the U.S. government and elites in Puerto Rico, who now are again going through the process of proving not just that Puerto Ricans are deserving of autonomy, but that we're deserving of autonomy because we are mixed, but we're becoming lighter and lighter.
Mm-hmm.
That program then went ahead with certain economic policies. So the idea that there were people in Puerto Rico who were lesser than because they were darker or were Afro-descendant went in hand with different economic policies whose purpose was to terraform Puerto Rico, to transform it in a way that modeled, you know, certain neoliberal economic policies. So for example, there was the idea that there was going to be a level of pressure exerted to push out about a third to a fourth of the workforce from Puerto Rico to the United States in order to create a cheap labor force. So this was part of something that was called Operation Bootstrap.
Mm-hmm.
So if you push almost a third of Puerto Ricans off the island, and then you provide massive tax cuts for corporations to come into Puerto Rico and establish their businesses and factories here, then that would allow the creation of a Puerto Rican middle class,
mm-hmm.
which would be conceived as being lighter and whiter. In line with those policies, you also have something called la operación, or mm-hmm. the surface, which was essentially a sterilization program, very much along the lines of what you saw in Harlem in African-American and Puerto Rican communities around the same time, was also happening in Puerto Rico. And there are certain studies that suggest that up until the 90s, roughly about a fifth to a fourth of Puerto Rican women had been sterilized against their will, without their knowledge, all in the interest of controlling the Puerto Rican population, again, because we're racially inferior, we're racially mixed, that makes us lesser than. You have to control those people, which, you know, some scholars argue overwhelmingly targeted Puerto Ricans who were poor, and likely also targeted Puerto Rican women who were darker skinned and black. So it's this whole, you know, earlier I mentioned in passing this notion of colonial racial capitalism. And just to unpack that a little bit, what that essentially means is how capitalism is inherently textured by racial discourse as part of a colonial project of extraction and oppression. So whether it's under Spain or it's under the United States, you have a very similar way of thinking about race and economics that has and continues to have an impact on our people, both on the island as well as the broader diaspora.
And we can't forget also that we have pro-independence movements that were like developing at the same time after 1898, and where they were repressed by the U.S. government through several medias, the FBI. They were like something called las carpetas, which was like basically FBI, and then like community people that were like Puerto Ricans were hired to like watch out for those pro-independence people because they were like subversives and they are socialists and communists. And like, if you become independent, you Puerto Ricans are going to be so poor, and if, you know, communists will reign in Puerto Rico. So that was like fed day after day through propaganda for many, many years until today's date, you know, like, and a lot of pro-independence people like say, I think people are watching me. There are people watching us. And so the government will deny that. The government usually will have elites who will be in support of the relationship with the US. So because that will facilitate all of these things to happen. So until there was an investigation and a pro-independence leader was finally able to get all these files on pro-independence people with dates, notes, everything. And, you know, you can talk to some of them and they will show you their file, the FBI. And sometimes they found who was the person who was informing or giving the information. Sometimes it was the neighbor. So here we see how the U.S. somehow divided us and we then can't trust each other, and how they undermine our capacities or our belief that we could be independent to this day. To this day, we are afraid sometimes to say that we support independence because of all of this history unconsciously is on our mind. So to today's date, there are a lot of things happening in Puerto Rico that are colonial. Like it would be like in our history books, for example, the passing of the PROMESA Act in 2016 that was signed by Obama, which established a fiscal control war on Puerto Rico because we got into a massive debt, but it was because our economy was just, there was not a plan, a real economic plan for Puerto Rico. So we rely on these companies that came to Puerto Rico to get like very low or no tax for them to pay. So how can the economy survive through these incentives? And it was all to, you know, we were accommodating to the American market because the companies will make products for the American market, not for what we needed. So we got in debt. The fiscal control board was established. And so what's been happening is that people feel like these were, first of all, unelected officials that are making decisions overriding Puerto Rico's laws. What more colonial than that? Mm-hmm. So now Puerto Rican people are trying to fight to get rid of them. There are some ideology behind of why we have the fiscal control board right now. And it's like those Puerto Ricans don't know how to balance the budget. Those Puerto Ricans are corrupt, you know, and we need to oversight their finances. And, you know, like there are many other things that like, for example, the current status, and it became official in 1952, is called the Free Association State, but we're not free. There's no association. We're not a state. So every time somebody talks to me about Puerto Rico, it's kind of like confusing. And it's very confusing to explain. So that's why we have this conversation today.
Right. No, I just want to share a quick personal anecdote, right? Because there is this idea for a long time of like, if you think about independence, you are literally crazy. When I was growing up, you know, there was this famous revolutionary leader of the Puerto Rican Independence Party and the movement, the Nationalist Party, called Pedro Albizu Campos, who was an Afro-Puerto Rican revolutionary. And my mom would always tell me growing up, going back to Amazas, my mom would tell me growing up, oh, well, you know, he was crazy. He thought there were laser beams that were attacking him. He would always cry about the laser beams and wrap himself up in a cold towel, like a crazy person. And I would just kind of internalize that, like, oh, this man was obviously psychotic, until precisely because of those, you know, different folders and data that were released of what the FBI was actually doing, it turned out to be true. He would be incarcerated and he would literally be cooked alive using not literal microwaves where we put a toaster strudel in, but like literally essentially weaponized microwaves. And there were, you know, very brutal pictures of his body being literally cooked alive by these things in ways that disabled him later in life. So it was a sort of arc for me of like hearing those messages that independence is not even a possibility. And anybody who thought that was crazy, when in reality, a lot of these leaders and people were arrested, were literally tortured and made disabled because of the torture that they were subjected to physically, and then having their names, you know, dragged through the mud in the public eye.
Actually, it was Luis Muñoz Marín, the one who said out loud that Pedro Albizu Campos was crazy.
Right.
Yeah, right. I read that in a history book, and I was like, this is kind of, you know, this is such a lie and gaslighting to the Puerto Rican people. Like, how you know, you torture somebody, like the FBI tortured this person, you know it because you're the governor of Puerto Rico, and you bring this story, like, he's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I find it so machiavellic when I think about it, like, so harmful, like, full of bad intention, deceiving of the Puerto Rican people. And so we wonder why a Puerto Rican would do that to another Puerto Rican. And again, it's like this division among ourselves that happened. And I think, like, Franz Fanon speaks to it in terms of what happens when a group of people are subject to colonization and what happens to the mind. Maybe we can talk a little bit about him. Who is him and why, you know, he's important to this discussion.
I accept any and all invitations to fanboy the fuck out on the Franz Fanon. Yes, please. Always, now, forever. So for folks who don't know his work, so Franz Omar Fanon was originally from Martinique, so also in the Caribbean, back when it was an unincorporated territory of France. So very similar situation to Puerto Rico, actually. And he grew up in Martinique, you know, very much having this identity as a Frenchman, right? As being a member of the French nation, not unlike, you know, many Puerto Ricans, even growing up in the island, who may feel, oh, we're American, we have American citizenship. And then we come to the U.S. mainland and suddenly things get a little complicated. So Franz Fanon, you know, really had this idea that he was a member of France and a French citizen, to the point that during the Second World War, he joins on the Allied side to fight against the Nazis in France. And then after the war, he starts to notice that even though he bled for his country, he was treated as a second-class citizen because he was Black and he was a colonial subject of a colony of France. And it was that experience that got him very interested in how the colonial situation gets internalized. How does it take root within the mind? And he, with the equivalent of what in the States you would call the GI Bill, he was able to use that to go to medical school, and he became a psychiatrist. Studied under François Le Tosquelles, who was a Catalan, Spaniard, Marxist psychoanalyst. He was a Freudo-Marxist. And so he was exposed through François de Tocqueville to Freud, Ferenczi, and Lacan, as well as a healthy helping of Marx. And he sort of used that, but he didn't just use those theories. He kind of adapted them for his own purposes to understand the colonial situation. So part of what he develops in his work across different books, whether it's Black Skin, White Mass, or Toward the African Revolution, or Wretched of the Earth, or any of the writings that you can find in Alienation and Freedom, which are all of his clinical papers translated into English, he argues that while much of psychiatry focus on biology, and Freud critiqued that with a focus on ontogeny, meaning the development of the individual throughout their lifespan, Fanon argued that ontogeny is important, but ontogeny must be understood in the context of what he called sociogeny. So not just do individuals develop over the lifespan, but societies and social structures develop over the span of history and in turn come to affect psychic experience. So when he talks about sociogeny, he wants to explore how psychic experience is formed not only in the context of intimate attachment relationships, object relations, and so forth, but how even all of that is formed in the context of culture, politics, society, and economics. With that model in mind, he tries to understand how it is that the colony functions precisely through a process of divide and conquer, and divide and conquer specifically along lines of race, class, and gender. So he talks about how it's not just the colonizer oppressing the colonized in sort of a one-sided way. The colonizer allows the creation of a upwardly mobile class among the colonized people, whose job it then is to ensure that the colonial situation continues. So people who might be, you know, members of the community itself, but who are able to achieve a level of economic mobility, of upward mobility, as a result of the colonial situation. An example I can think of here in the United States, you could think of, for example, Richard Nixon, who at one point in the post-civil rights world, he starts to argue, we need to convince African-Americans and Latinos that they have a part in the American dream and that they have a part in our American capitalist system in order to disarm any revolutionary energies that might emerge from marginalized communities. So that's essentially the logic of the colony. It's how to turn a people against themselves by promising that some will move up so long as the majority still exists in conditions of precarity. What Fanon called a kind of pecking order of the colonial situation, and one that you can't really separate from race, class, and gender, but it's indelibly co-constituted by race, class, and gender at the same time, which led him to write at one point, to be rich is to be white, and to be white is to be rich. And he doesn't mean that as like a literal phenotypical truth, but he means us in the sense that under a colonial racial capitalist situation, not only will people pursue, say, wanting to be lighter, having straight hair, et cetera, but will also pursue that upward mobility, and oftentimes the two being seen as coterminous, that in order to be more accepted, in order to succeed, in order to move up, you have to fall in line with these ideologies. And they're incredibly seductive. To be clear, it's not a matter of who are the bad people and who are the good people. It's not about good Puerto Ricans versus bad Puerto Ricans. If anything, that's the very logic of the colony, which is to say that there are bad Puerto Ricans and that we're going to distinguish ourselves from them because we're the good ones. We are the ones who deserve. And they, whoever the fantasized they is, are those who do not.
Well, I can think of examples of what you just said, and I heard comments like, oh, I won't move to Florida because from Puerto Ricans, because right. It's full of Puerto Ricans and Florida is going to get all like things are gonna go bad soon. You know, or like
Oh,
in
because
terms
Puerto
of,
Ricans are moving there?
yeah, because it's getting full of Puerto Ricans. So it's gonna be
All
soon.
right.
So that's why I'm gonna move to a different state where there are not many Puerto Ricans. I'm not gonna go to New York, or I'm not gonna go to Chicago. And the resident commissioner of Puerto Rico, who represents us in Congress, having an exchange with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so we see like the resident commissioner, she represents the white elite in Puerto Rico in terms of like, first of all, she assumed the discourse, colonialism, the discourse of like assimilation, right-wing politics, and she justifies the colonial structures. And then she engages in these kinds of conversations with another Puerto Rican who is in the diaspora, which is that there's a whole other dynamic in terms of Puerto Ricans in the diaspora and Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico, like who is more Puerto Rican than whom. And
Right.
so, yeah, so that's part of also like divide and conquer. And that we can also see how if you want to be in power in Puerto Rico and the political structures, you need to assume this discourse of assimilation to the U.S. so that you can have a space. And right now, what we're seeing politically is that some of that is being pushed back. People like are starting to think differently about this a little bit. And I think you mentioned that in your study too, how in the literature review, you mentioned something about how people are thinking about other possibilities because they are being able to deconstruct all of this colonial mentality with recent events that have been happening in Puerto Rico, like Hurricane Maria. We always thought that if something really bad happened to Puerto Rico, we would have the U.S. as a savior that would rescue. And we didn't see that with Hurricane Maria. We realized that we helped ourselves and that we were there for each other, and that the diaspora in the U.S. and other parts of the world were the ones who responded faster and quicker than the U.S. government. So it proves that we can take care of ourselves. We can like assume responsibility for ourselves. And then there is this other thought of like, if you are not helping us, why are you here? So people are starting to like to reconsider all of this thinking. And I think it has been a historic process too, for that to be deconstructed. So I'm thinking also, I have some thoughts about like the internalization of like inferiority and how all of that is implemented through, I mentioned this earlier about needing supervision. Some of the things that I hear from Puerto Ricans is like, we need the US to help us with corruption. Like if the US is not, you know, supervising us, it's gonna be a mess because right now there is a lot of corruption. So we need the FBI to, you know, to watch us. Like kind of, it's like very infantile thought or thinking process. Like what kind of adult will say, I need somebody to supervise me unless there are, you know, there's some like real problems. I need somebody to supervise me because I don't know how to manage my money, or I don't know how to, you know, live independently. There's some individuals that might need that kind of help. But in generally, like the expectation is that you can do it on your own. And the other thought that I've heard a lot, the other idea, like we also have like these imaginary scenarios as Puerto Ricans of like what would happen to us if somebody invades us or there is a war, and you know, who's gonna protect us? I don't know if you heard about that in Daniel.
I often what I hear more often is like we're gonna become Venezuela or Cuba if we become independent. I don't know that I've heard the, you know, somebody's going to invade us. Like, I'd have to think, like, who wants to invade Puerto Rico?
But I mean, that's the thought. Like, I've heard that for a long time. Well, we need the United States because if there's a war, we need somebody to protect us. And I've heard that, like, from many other Puerto Ricans. Not only people who just repeat it without thinking, but also Puerto Ricans who question that idea. And now you're like, as an adult, you think about it and like, well, who's going to invade us? And I think your study also kind of like touch upon some of those things.
So actually, you know, retroactively, because they mentioned you're going to publish in Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where this study is going to get published, Journal of Psychoanalytics.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
congratulations to you. You're awesome. I'm awesome. We're both awesome together. So the study that I did, it was building on some of other work. So somebody that, you know, we cherish and admire a lot, Ritalis Capio Rosario at Arizona State University, who did some of the, you know, original, really cutting edge work looking at colonial mentality among Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico and the diaspora broadly. And we received some mentoring and consultation from her to launch a similar study focused on folks who were either in the diaspora or who had moved to New York City. The reason being, most of the studies that had been carried out were either with people in Puerto Rico or people who had recently migrated from Puerto Rico to Florida. And so we were interested in, well, what are these processes of assimilation and upward mobility and dealing with race and class? What does that look like for people who've now been living in the States for generations who come from Puerto Rico? And so we conducted this mixed methods qualitative study informed by a decolonial psychoanalytic point of view. And we asked people a series of questions around about three or four domains. One being about how they would describe their own Puerto Ricanness, their Puerto Rican identity. How would they describe other Puerto Ricans and the way that other Puerto Ricans thought, felt, and behaved? How would they describe white people and white identity? How did they imagine white people would describe Puerto Ricans? And then we asked three questions about the colonial situation. How would you describe the current relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico? What do you think would happen if the U.S.-Puerto Rico relationship were to continue? What do you think would happen if it were to end? And those questions, they were spicy. Like, they brought up a lot of really spicy material. And because we're using the psychoanalytic approach, it was very free associative. So people were really unpacking a lot of anxieties and feelings that they had. For context, in terms of the findings, well, I'll just review this briefly. So something we did not expect, but that happened organically, is that half of the sample were Puerto Ricans who identified as multiracial. You know, folks might remember the earlier point of this conversation where we talked about mestizaje and mixture, right? So there were half of the sample that identified as multiracial, as mixed, and then the other half identified as Black, as Afro-descendant Puerto Ricans. And we found that they had very different responses to these questions. To make a long story short, our subsample that identified as multiracial would have a lot of anxiety about whether Puerto Rico could even survive without the United States. Or if there was to be an end to the relationship, it would be with a lot of help from the U.S. A lot of people talked about how they really needed the U.S. to hold Puerto Rico's hand. They also used a lot of parental metaphors, I think just as you yourself experienced, where they would say, you know, Puerto Rico is like an abandoned child, or the United States is like, you know, it's like a step parent who adopted you and then dropped you, or is a parent that's supposed to, who is supposed to take care of you, but doesn't and just leaves you with all these needs. So, he dicho Freud yo, you know, was I, you know, trying to be super Freudian psychoanalytic, you know, a little bit, just a little bit. But this came up organically, the ways that people narrativize, not just whether we were capable of doing it on our own, but the way in which it was a very parentified metaphor of how people even thought about the U.S. and Puerto Rico. Whereas our participants who identified as Black Puerto Ricans, their sense was more like, it'll be really hard if the U.S.-Puerto Rico relationship were to end and Puerto Rico becomes independent. There'll be economic challenges, political challenges. It's going to be extremely difficult. But we are a resilient people. We're going to make it work. We're going to make it work, and we just have to keep moving forward and create a new world for us, which was, you know, very moving to witness, but also very fraught, because it sort of suggested that because of the sort of racial and class makeup of the United States, some people may feel more attached to keeping the relationship going, whereas other people might feel, one participant from our Black identified sample said, look, we're already on the bottom. We're not even at the bottom. We're below the bottom. We can only move up from here. So it's a sentiment that what do we have to lose if we were to roll the dice, cross the Rubicon, and push for our own independence and freedom?
That's so interesting. How, like, you know, like what it makes me think of, like, there are a lot of arguments about, you know, for the pro-independence people that talks about how, you know, how difficult it would be for Puerto Rico to become a state based on the current politics, racial politics that's happening right now. Because we've seen recently, like how, you know, racism is out there. Like, when we thought it was being, you know, some people thought, oh, you know, we've overcome racism, whatever that means. But, like, it's been more, like, out there. And so Puerto Ricans, a lot of Puerto Ricans feel like, I don't want to be part of that. You know, I don't want to, you know, have to, I don't want to subject my people to that kind of discrimination. We already are being discriminated, like 5 million people live in the U.S. I don't know how that would change in terms of, like, if we become independent, these people would not get discriminated, but we're already living here. But, like, for, like, if there is racism right now in terms of the policies that are being enacted in Puerto Rico from Congress, what would happen if we actually become part of the U.S.? And so I don't think that's something that a lot of people, like, think about. They think more about the U.S. as a protector of
right.
Puerto Rico, under the idea of being inclusive, you know, bringing equality.
Right. So there's a very interesting debate along those lines. So I don't know if you know Ramón Grosfuguel.
No.
So Ramón Grosfuguel is a Puerto Rican philosopher who came up with this idea of what he called radical statehood. And the idea would be that if Puerto Rico were to become the 51st state, then we would sort of, you know, join hands with the working class in the United States and other people of color in the United States, and we would sort of, you know, change the empire from within, from the belly of the beast. And that idea didn't go very far. It didn't go very far because if you look at the research on folks who are more pro-statehood, they tend to be more right-wing, support more conservative economic policy, and tend to be more, you know, conservative on issues of gender, sexuality, etc. So statehood is very wrapped up with a whole bunch of other things. And I don't think it would fully work. There's also the fact that if you look at the 2002 census, where you had something like 85%, 89% of Puerto Ricans identifying as white. And if you look at that data from 2002 to today, the latest data suggests that number has gone down, and it's now maybe about 40 to 50% of Puerto Ricans identifying as white. And everyone has sort of shifted either to some notion of being multiracial or more people who feel a greater freedom to identify as Black and Indigenous. So it suggests that as we have been going through what we've been going through in Puerto Rico, and as people on the island see everything going on in the States in terms of race and racism, I think you're right. I think people are sort of, again, waking up to the idea of, I don't know if I want to go there. I don't know if I want to be part of the U.S. if the U.S. means all of that.
Well, I think part of the colonial narrative is that we need to move here so that we can move up the ladder.
Exactly.
Like you talked
about.
You know, we and there's nothing wrong with echar palante, which is moving forward. It might feel like there's nothing wrong, you know, like there's nothing evil about that phrase, but it's a very capitalist narrative that so we have to, you know, make an effort to be the best and obtain the materials and the money and the position and status that we we want,
I
the only way we're going to attain that is if we move to the United States.
See, I can't hear Be the Best anymore without thinking about the Pokemon theme song. I want to be the very best that no one ever. See, it's the difference between echan pa'lante, moving forward, in the sense of we have to echar pa'lante, like we have to move forward as a people, right? Versus echar pa'lante meaning me, myself, and I. Which gets into that more capitalistic, individualistic, you know, I'm just going to move up and everyone else, se fuñeron, they got screwed. It is very much like I'm moving around in a space, whether it's psychoanalytic spaces, professional spaces, even when I go down to DC, when I was doing like APA type advocacy, where like, depending on how I'm moving, how I'm wearing that day and how I'm perceived, right? I can very much slip under the radar, which will lead people to say sometimes very messed things up to me that they wouldn't say to somebody who was darker, right? But then depending on how I'm moving, how I'm, what I'm wearing that day, how I'm being seen, then suddenly something can shift in someone's mind and I can become perceived as sort of like hypermasculine, dangerous Latino male. And there's a way in which I've had to sort of realize that the question of how my color is perceived is something that is inherently classed, meaning there's a class dimension, and it's inherently gendered. So I often do notice that when I'm perceived as white, there's a way in which I'm seen as safer, more effeminate. People will more often than not assume that I'm gay. Versus when I'm seen as a racial threat, suddenly I'm seen as hyper masculine and all these different things. So there's like so many different factors that go into that kind of chameleon-like dynamic that makes it a symptom and also a privilege of the possibility of assimilation, right? Regardless of whether I want to assimilate or not, is not entirely irrelevant, but it's secondary to how other people place me on the chessboard, right? Whether I'm going to be the first one to get put at the front of the line or whether I'm going to be told to take some steps back. So it's very dynamic, but just because it's very dynamic doesn't mean that it isn't real, that there is, and sometimes other Latinos get anxious when I say this, but that there is a kind of, not a kind of, but that there is sort of white Latino privilege and that there is whiteness among our communities. I harp so much on the sort of, you know, racialized telling of our history, because otherwise there's a way that Puerto Ricanness can slip into a generic brown. And that generic brown leaves out too many things, like not only, you know, Afro-Puerto Ricans, it also allows white Puerto Ricans not just to sneak in under the radar hanging out with Americans, but to sneak in under the radar of the kind of elite powers that they wind up being able to mobilize back on the island. So when I introduce myself and like describing my identities, for that reason, I'll say I'm a white Puerto Rican, because to not name that would be to leave something silent that could be quite problematic and dangerous.
I am happy that, Daniel, that you are able to articulate that piece, because I try to articulate it to other people, and they have a hard time coming from a person of color like me, a brown Puerto Rican. I mean, I've been subject to a lot of microaggressions since I moved to the U.S., in Puerto Rico as well. But when I moved to the U.S., and, you know, like people have a lot of comments to say about my identity. And I know the browner and the darker and the more like African that you look, the more, you know, you're going to be subject to that kind of treatment. So when I talk to other Puerto Ricans or immigrants or people like Latinx people, some of them I say, I haven't had that experience. Oh, I'm surprised. And there are some identities that they have that are different than mine. Like some of them are men. So there is some male privilege, you know. And so some of them are white. And so it's very hard to name it and not receive a defensive response back. I work on a dissertation called the Immigrant Psychotherapist of Color. And part of it was because I also identify myself, like in terms of the immigrant experience. I had gone through some of that, a lot of that, and also color in terms of brown, dark, or something that identifies you away from the white phenotype, European phenotype. Because I wanted to hear those stories, you know, in terms of being microaggressed. And so for me, I struggled with that when I was trying to define what a person of color was and how to explain that to people without feeling offended and say, hey, there is a reality out there that when you walk out of the door and you're brown, dark, curly hair, there is a very different treatment. And that's what I want to gather. And in terms of the immigrant experience, I think there's something that's been denied of the Puerto Rican for the Puerto Rican people and its experience of identifying the immigrant or the migrant experience. I've gone through a lot of that in terms of feeling homesick, feeling disconnected, feeling lost. And some people here in the U.S., I think that they trivialize it by saying, oh, I moved from one state to another. I know what homesickness feels. And I'm like, it's not the same. We're literally moving from another country. We call Puerto Rico a country, our country, nuestro país. That's part of the whole confusion. Like, this is a country that has been, like, controlled, invaded, and our process of becoming a nation has been disrupted, but it's there. And so we feel like when we move from Puerto Rico to the U.S. that we literally immigrated, but it's not obviously because we don't go through similar like legalities like other immigrants, and I know that that put them in a lot of jeopardy and danger. I don't want to minimize that piece. But there is, at this point, if you go to some Puerto Ricans' neighborhood, there are a lot of poverty in our communities. So I think we need to move beyond the logic of, you know, the legalities to understand the psychic experience of what's like to move from Puerto Rico to the United States. And some of the people who favor statehood, I've heard some of them denying the experience of being that diaspora or like being going through difficulties in the U.S. because you immigrated, because they want to trivialize that experience because we are part of the U.S., you know. So I just wanted to mention that too.
Thanks for listening. If you liked it and thought it was interesting, share it on social media and hope you listen to our next episode of Diasporica, a podcast that bridges the Puerto Rican diaspora and Puerto Rico.